watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests, and I'm Lynn Gary. First, I want to greet and acknowledge listeners on CFUV Victoria, BC, and CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia. Second, I want to apologize to local listeners of WEOS and Ithaca Community Radio for the equipment problems at WEOS that resulted in the show that I produced for last week not being heard here in the Finger Lakes. I'm going to play that show for Finger Lakes listeners next week because I don't want you to miss what the others have already heard. A two-hour presentation by architect Richard Gage, providing proofs that the three World Trade Center skyscrapers were brought down by expertly placed explosives on September 11th, 2001. That topic would be incredibly timely for this week's program, of course. But what I'm presenting you is even more timely for local listeners. An incredible person will be here in the area September 14th through 16th, and I wanted you to have the opportunity to meet and learn from him if you choose. He's Darren Doherty, one of Australia's top permaculture designers. He specializes in a type of work called keyline design. Keyline design is a system which was originally devised to rehumidify the dry landscapes of Australia and thus speed the creation and regeneration of living topsoils. But as you will hear this week, one of the creators of the keyline system believes that the soil regeneration it performs, if used on the planet's farmland, could remove enough excess CO2 from the atmosphere to restore the climate balance of the planet. I'll give you information on how you can attend Darren's events at the end of the program, so you may want to get something to write with by then. On the program this week, we'll take on the relationship between environmental harm and political economy from three different vantage points. The problem of the destruction of our environment cannot be separated from economics. And economics, as someone has said, is politics. Environmental destruction, whether climate destabilization or the myriad forms of human-induced pollution we've been forced to endure, result not from technological failures so much as political ones. The politics of power and disempowerment, driven by economic motives, is the salient determining factor, according to the research of our first speaker, economist James Boyce of the University of Massachusetts. He was interviewed recently by C.S. Sung of Against the Grain, an excellent program produced at KPFA Pacifica Radio. Here's C.S. Sung.
What does damage to the environment correlate with? For one thing, it correlates with the number of polluting corporations. Obviously, the more factories spewing chemicals into a waterway increases the damage to that waterway. Does environmental damage also correlate with inequality. We've been hearing a lot about widening disparities in income and wealth. Does greater inequality in a society mean a change in the amount of environmental harm, either more damage or less? My guest today has written a working paper entitled, Is Inequality Bad for the Environment? James Boyce is an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a staffer at the Political Economy Research Institute. He is author of, among other books, The Political Economy of the Environment, and he co-edited the volume Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership. James Boyce joins us now by phone from Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, C.S.
You begin this paper by indicating what you mean by the term environmental harm. How do you define it?
Well, the way I define it is in terms of the impact of the environment on long-term human well-being. In other words, I'm enough of a mainstream economist to believe that the reason we want to worry about environmental damage, about natural resource depletion, pollution, and so on, is that it has impacts on us, on people, today and in future generations. So when I talk about environmental harm, that's what I'm talking about. There is, as you probably know, an alternative view that humans are just one other species and that it's speciesist to privilege human well-being and that really we're no more important than, you know, any bird or beetle or anything else. And while I have a certain amount of sympathy for protection of other species, in the end, I come down pretty solidly in favor of human well-being as the long-term goal. In general, I think, you know, having a better world for humans means having a better world for other organisms as well. But, of course, there are exceptions. I mean, one of the exceptions I mentioned in the paper has to do with malaria mosquitoes. One of the main ways in which malaria has been controlled around the world, the way it was controlled in the United States, the way it was controlled in Northern and Western Europe in the 19th century, is by modifying the environment to basically ensure that you don't have the stagnant bodies of water in which the malaria-bearing mosquitoes thrive. So that's an environmental change that I would view as a good thing, even though it was bad for another species, namely the malaria mosquitoes and the malaria bacteria themselves. So I think it's, you know, it's a philosophical question. What's environmental harm? But for me, the starting point for answering it is to think about the well-being of people today and in the future.
Now, of course, we can't talk about inequality without talking about power. And here you bring up purchasing power and political power, and you relate purchasing power to a question like how much pollution is too much. Tell us what you're thinking about here.
Well, when economists do analyses, cost-benefit analyses regarding environmental protection, and they're trying to determine how much, what's it worth to cut down air pollution or to preserve forests or whatever, they end up having to come up with some way to put dollar values on the benefits of doing those things to compare with the dollar costs of installing pollution control equipment or managing the forest more sustainably or what have you. And so the problem is, how does one come up with the dollar costs? Well, the way that that's typically, or the dollar benefits, rather, of protecting the environment. And the way that that's typically done is based on people's willingness to pay for a better environment. So sometimes that takes the form of surveys. You know, people will ask, they'll phone up and say, how much would you be willing to pay to preserve the spotted owl, etc. Sometimes it's done by observing behavior. You look and see how much more expensive are houses that are comparable in other ways, but one's closer to an environmental hazard, say an airport with noise pollution, air pollution, and so on, than another house, and you get a sense of how much people are willing to pay to have a house in a better environment. And so there are these various techniques that people use, economists use, to come up with the value of protecting the environment. And none of the techniques are perfect, but one of the things that all the techniques tend to have in common is that they're based on willingness to pay. Now, that might seem sensible because, after all, that's the way most prices are determined in markets. I mean, you know, how much are people willing to pay for orange juice or gasoline or what have you? But the problem is that willingness to pay, of course, is shaped by ability to pay. People
Sure.
who have more dollars have more votes in this contest, and people who have fewer dollars have fewer votes. And so in deciding what kind of environmental protection is worth the cost, where are the benefits from protecting the environment the greatest, and where can the environment be turned into a sacrifice zone, it turns out that people's willingness to pay, the amount of money that people can put behind their preferences is a criterion for policymaking, even apart from the political factors that then intervene further down the road.
And then with purchasing power, we have political power. What kinds of forms does political power take, and to what extent do these two kinds of power, political and purchasing, correlate with or reinforce each other?
Well, political power encompasses a number of ways that decisions get made outside of the market. You know, within the markets, it's purchasing power that drives things, and in a way, cost-benefit analysis is just trying to extend that logic to public policy. But of course, we know that public policy isn't made by cost-benefit analysis. It's not made by an economist sitting in front of his or her computer crunching the numbers. It's made through a political process, and in that political process, some voices speak louder than other voices. In particular, there is the exercise of power to determine what is and is not on the political agenda. That's what sometimes is called agenda power. There's power when two different something is on the agenda and two different parties disagree out of what ought to be done. One prevails. That's what sometimes is called decision power. Those are the kinds of power that political scientists tend to think about and write about a fair amount. In addition to that, there's some deeper forms of power. One of the interesting and important ways I think power is brought to bear on environmental and other issues is what sometimes is called value power, the power to shape other people's values, to propagandize them in effect, right, through advertising or whatever. So in the case of the environment, to convince people that pollution doesn't matter or that it's worth the cost to have the benefits that one gets by having these polluting activities. So in effect, through value power, you don't need to control the political agenda anymore. You don't need to control the decisions anymore because you can let people make decisions themselves and they'll make the decision you wanted because you've influenced their values. So that's another form of political power. And then finally, there's what sometimes is called event power, the power just to change the circumstances under which people live. So when a corporation comes and puts a factory in a neighborhood and the neighborhood doesn't have any voice in affecting whether or not that's going to happen, the corporation has in effect exercised event power. They've changed the circumstances under which the people in that neighborhood have lived. And so that's another very important part of power that's implicated in a lot of environmental decision making.
And a lot of this political power seems to have a lot to do with money, with purchasing power, correct?
Sure. The two are correlated. I mean, the correlation's not perfect, but in general, people who have more money tend to have more political power and vice versa. Now, it's important to recognize that it's not a perfect correlation for two reasons. One is you can find examples around the world where wealth has been relatively equally distributed, and yet there's been a lot of political inequality. I mean, the former Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc countries would be a good example. They had relatively egalitarian distributions of wealth and income, at least personal wealth and personal income, and yet very unequal distributions of political power, and the environmental outcomes you got in the Soviet Union were pretty horrendous, and I would say a lot of that can be explained by the fact that you had unaccountable, very strong political power making decisions about things like nuclear plants, etc., right? So that's one reason why it's important to recognize that money and political power aren't identical. And the other reason is that in a democracy, even an imperfect democracy, like any real-world democracy is, the fact is that people do have the ability to mobilize and organize and express their views, express their opposition. So even if some people have a lot more money than other people, the fact that people can mobilize and change things is one of the things that means that history is not a foregone conclusion. It's the way we got, you know, the labor movement and the women's movement and the 8-hour day and environmental protection and the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, all these things came about through oppositional movements where people got together and found the power that comes through unity, even in the absence of a lot of purchasing power to back that up.
James Boyce teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is author of a number of books, including Investing in Peace, Aid and Conditionality After Civil Wars. He co-edited the book Natural Assets, Democratizing Environmental Ownership. Jim, when we look at economic activities that generate environmental harm, that harm the environment, what can we conclude about which people benefit perhaps disproportionately from those economic activities?
Well, that's a really good question, C.S., and it's something that often's left out of the conversation. But I think whenever we look at economic activities that degrade the environment, that deplete resources or pollute the air, water, and land, we can ask that question, who benefits from the activities that create this problem? If nobody benefited, or at least nobody thought they were benefiting, the activities wouldn't take place. We can also ask, who bears the cost? Who are the people who are adversely impacted by this? If no one was adversely impacted, at least from the standpoint of human well-being, we wouldn't worry about it. And third, we can ask, why is it that the people who benefit, those who win, are able to impose these costs on others, the people who lose? So those seem to me to be the core questions that we need to ask in trying to understand environmental degradation and what we can do about it. Now, your question was, who are the people who tend to be the winners, who tend to be the beneficiaries? Well, in general, those tend to be the people with more purchasing power and more political power. If you think about the benefits from economic activities that degrade the environment, there are two main sorts of benefits. They're the benefits that come to the producers in the form of profits, and they're the benefits that come to the consumers in the form of lower prices for things that, if they had to pay full freight, if there weren't environmental degradation associated with the production of those goods, the prices would likely be higher. And so you're looking at beneficiaries from the economic activities on both the producer side and the consumer side, and the question is, who are those people? Well, you know, who are the people who reap most of the profits? They're the wealthier people who own stocks and, you know, corporations and so on. Who are the people who get most of the benefits on the consuming side? Well, they're the people who consume the most. And who are they? They're the people with the most purchasing power, the people who can afford to consume a lot. So the people who get the biggest chunk of the benefits from environmentally degrading activities tend to be, this is a generalization, but it's a generalization that I think holds around the world, tend to be the people who own most of the productive resources and or consume most of the goods and services in the society. In other words, the elites.
What do you mean when you write that many environmental costs are localized? And what does this localization mean, or what does it allow wealthy and powerful people to do?
Well, if you think about activities that degrade the environment, occasionally those activities have global effects. Global warming is the best example of that. But more often, the effects are localized in the sense that it's particular places that are adversely impacted, particular places that are deforested, that are strip mined, that are polluted, contaminated in terms of their air, their drinking water, their land, and so on. And so that's the localization. The harm isn't inflicted equally on everybody in the world. It's afflicted on particular people who depend for their livelihoods, for where they live, for where they work, for where they play, for where they pray, on particular locations. It's those people who are particularly affected by environmental degradation. And so what that localization opens up is the possibility that the folks who are benefiting from the activities that degrade the environment aren't necessarily the same people as the ones who are going to bear those environmental costs. They can be far away from the scene. So you can have the polluting activities or the resource depleting activities located in one place, out of sight and more or less out of mind of the people who benefit from those environmentally degrading activities. So it's one of the ways in which this kind of distancing happens between action and effect, between cause and consequence. It's one way that people can, I suspect it's one of the ways people can live with themselves. The people who benefit from these activities can live with themselves not only because they don't bear the consequences, but they don't even actually see or know the people who are affected by those consequences.
And what roles do race and ethnicity play here in determining which communities are exposed to more environmental harm?
I think they play a huge role. The extent varies from place to place and country to country, but here in the United States, it's very clear that race and ethnicity play enormously important roles in deciding where environmental hazards are located. Study after study has shown that activities that create environmental degradation, toxic air pollution, for example, storage and transfer facilities, incinerators, you go down the list, they tend disproportionately to be located in communities of color, in communities with above average numbers of Hispanic or Latinos, of African Americans, Asian Americans, and Native Americans. You find that all over the United States to a greater or lesser extent. And it's not just because these communities are poor, right? If it was just a matter of income, you'd expect that once you control for income, there wouldn't be any difference between predominantly African American, let's say, and predominantly Anglo-white communities. And yet you find in these studies that even controlling for income, you get an effect from race and ethnicity. Income matters. For sure. Low-income whites are at much greater risk of having these hazards imposed on them than high-income whites. But holding income constant, your chances of getting exposed to these hazards are much greater if you happen to be a person of color.
So we've talked about people who benefit from economic activities that degrade the environment. We've talked about people who bear a disproportionate share of the costs of such economic activities. Let's talk about environmental harm overall. And the question I think I began this hour with, and that's addressed in, you know, in some detail in your working paper, is inequality bad for the environment, has to do with whether widening inequality causes or correlates with more environmental harm overall. And here you bring up two scenarios depending on whether the beneficiaries of the economic activities we've been talking about are more powerful than those who bear the costs of those activities, or vice versa. Make that easier, actually, for our audience to understand. Tell us more about that.
Okay, well, the basic idea here, CS, is that where the people who benefit from the environmentally degrading activity are more powerful than those who bear the costs, you're going to get more of that activity taking place. They're going to use that power to make it happen. And the people who are on the cost side of the equation have less power to resist. And where it's turned around, where the people who benefit are relatively poor or powerless, and the people who would bear the cost are relatively rich or powerful, you're going to get less of that activity. So in trying to figure out how the degree of inequality between the relatively powerful and the relatively less powerful, between the rich and the poor, trying to get a handle on how that degree of inequality affects the sum total of environmental degradation, you got these two things going on which cut in different directions depending on which is more common. So the question is, which kind of environmental activity is more environmentally degrading activity is more common? Is it the kinds that benefit the rich and hurt the poor, or the kinds that benefit the poor and hurt the rich? And in general, I think there are really good reasons to think that the former is the more common, that the more common scenario is the one in which those who benefit are relatively well off for the reasons I've already described. They're the ones with the purchasing power to get all the commodities that are cheaper by the fact that environmental costs are externalized or left out of the equation. They're the people who own the shares in the corporations that make more money as a result of not having to install pollution control equipment or change their technologies in ways that would protect the environment more, right? So those tend to be, as we've already talked about, the people who are not only wealthier but have more political power. And so it's the most common scenario, I think, is one in which the winners from these activities are relatively well-to-do, and those who bear the costs are the relatively disadvantaged in both the economic playing field in terms of their purchasing power and in terms of the political playing field in terms of their clout. Now, that's not to say the other thing never happens. I mean, at the beginning of the paper that you were referring to, I have a little sort of scene setter describing a situation that I witnessed in Bangladesh a long time ago when I was living there in the 1970s, and my partner Betsy Hartman and I were working on a book called A Quiet Violence, which is about the lives of ordinary Bangladeshis. And it was in a period where the country was in really bad shape, much worse shape than it is today, and there had been a famine, and there were a lot of people who'd come into the capital city, Dhaka, and were living in squatters' colonies and trying trying to find a way to make ends meet, doing labor jobs, in some cases begging on the streets and so on. And the city government, which was, as most city governments, disproportionately representative of the interests of the upper and middle classes, decided to launch a beautification campaign to clean up DACA. And what cleaning up DACA meant was bulldozing the squatter colonies that these poor people lived in, and even more than that, getting the poor people themselves out of the city. And one time we were walking into the general post office, and right in downtown DACA, and there was a beggar woman who'd been sitting on the ground with a baby, begging for alms. And when we came back out, a police truck was rolling down the street, and it was picking up beggars and throwing them into the back of the truck to relocate them, to dump them far outside the city where they wouldn't be visual eyesores for the wealthier residents of the city. And the mother of the baby had wandered off. She must have gone down the, you know, following somebody from whom she was hoping to get a few coins, and she left the baby sitting there on this filthy rag on the sidewalk, and the policeman just came and picked up this baby and threw it on the back of the truck and drove off as if the baby were a piece of garbage. Oh. It's something I've never forgotten, right? And that, I think, is a good example of a situation where, who would benefit by getting rid of the beggars and the poor people in DACA? It was the rich, right? And who were the people who benefited from the so-called environmental problem, from being there in DACA and trying to stay alive and get work? It was the poor. And so it's an example of that other kind of situation where you get what I would describe as, in a perverse sense, too much environmental cleanup at the expense of the poor. Another example would be game preserves in Africa, where the people who've lived for generations in certain localities are excluded from hunting so that tourists can fly in and take pictures of the animals. That's an example of environmental protection for the rich at the expense of the poor. But I think in again the more common scenario is one in which the beneficiaries of the activities that degrade the environment are relatively well-to-do and powerful, and the victims of that environmental degradation are the relatively poor and relatively less powerful.
Jim Boyce, we're talking about a working paper he wrote for the Political Economy Research Institute, of which he is a staffer. It's entitled, "Is Inequality Bad for the Environment?" And you can read the paper. We have a link to it on againstthegrain.org. He also is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. My name is C.S. Song. And Jim Boyce has written a lot about peace, about the environment, about democracy. His books include Investing in Peace, The Political Economy of the Environment, and, as he said, A Quiet Violence. And he has written a working paper. It was published this past April, entitled, "Is Inequality Bad for the Environment?" Jim, you've participated in a study of the 50 states, comparing those with more equitable distributions of power and those with less. What did you find in the way of environmental results?
Well, that was a test of the same hypothesis we were just talking about, C.S., the hypothesis being that where there's more inequality, on balance, you'll get more environmental harm. And so in order to try to see, well, how do the facts, you know, what we can observe stack up with that prediction, some colleagues and I collected data from the 50 states in the U.S. in one of the studies we've done on this, and we developed an index of power disparities by state. We looked at things like fairness of the tax system and Medicaid access and voter participation and so on to get a measure that reflected how equally or unequally power was distributed in each of the 50 states. By that particular measure, Minnesota has the most equitable distribution of power in the country, and Mississippi has the least equitable. That's probably not a big surprise, right? Mm-hmm. And so we then looked and saw how does that that variable, that power inequality measure, how does that relate? How does that stack up when we look at the strength of environmental policies at the state level and at environmental outcomes in terms of, you know, what happens to environmental quality by multiple measures? And what we found was a very strong and clear relationship. The states with the most unequal distribution of power tended to have the weakest environmental policies and the worst environmental outcomes. And they also had the worst public health outcomes. I mean, we went one step further and said, okay, if there's a more polluted or damaged environment, that's going to be bad for people's health. And let's see if we can see that connection in the data looking at the 50 states as well. And sure enough, we did. So, and by contrast, a state with relatively equitable distribution of power would tend to have stronger environmental policies, better environmental outcomes, and better public health outcomes. I did the same kind of analysis internationally, comparing countries around the world with similar kinds of findings. The findings were particularly strong for low-income countries, in fact, for the poorer countries of Asia, Africa, Latin America, where you had a more equitable distribution of income and wealth, you tended to get better environmental outcomes. So I think there's at least some evidence emerging that's consistent with this surmise that where you've got more inequality, you're going to get worse environmental outcomes. In other words, to answer the question in the title of my working paper, yes, inequality is bad for the environment. It's bad for everybody. In fact, it's potentially even bad for the people who are relatively well off by whatever, you know, standard of inequality you're using. The relatively rich, the relatively powerful, they themselves might be worse off in a more inegalitarian society because environmental circumstances, even though they can distance themselves from some of the localized bads, those environmental circumstances in the end are impacting on them as well. There's another wonderful study that looks at an aspect of this by a woman who's just moved to teach in environmental health at UC Berkeley, in fact, where you're at, Rachel Morello Frosch. And she and a colleague did a study that looked at residential segregation in the United States and environmental conditions. And what they found was that in metropolitan areas that have higher degrees of racial segregation, you got worse environmental quality, not only in the poorer and darker neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that were predominantly of people of color, which had, as we were talking about before, the highest levels of environmental hazards, but even the relatively white Anglo upper class, upper income communities in those very segregated areas tended to have worse environmental quality than in metropolitan areas in this country where there wasn't the same degree of segregation. So what that makes me think is that the inequality not only impacts the poor, impacts the relatively powerless, impacts the people of color, it even is a bad thing for those who think that they're somehow better off by virtue of this inequality.
Your paper also touches on ethics, and in that regard, you refer to moral capital, and I wonder if you could define moral capital and describe the extent to which it is encouraged or discouraged by markets and how they operate.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, this phrase moral capital, you don't find that often in economics. but I think behind the scenes of the way an economy operates, a lot of what makes it function is in fact deeply rooted morality that people bring to their day-to-day lives. I mean, why do people not steal more, cheat more than they do? It's partly because they have a sense of what's right and wrong. A lot of economics assumes people are always out to maximize their self-interest and they'll do anything they can get away with. But I think to a large extent, people want to do the right thing. I mean, obviously not everybody's perfect and there are times when, you know, circumstances compel people to do the wrong thing or whatever. But in general, I think people want to do the right thing. And that moral capital is important with regard to environmental issues, partly because doing the right thing vis-a-vis the environment is partly not a question of just, you know, what's the cost, what's the benefit to me, or what are the laws, but also people's sense of what's the right thing to do. Is it right to pollute the air or not? And I think that's particularly important when we're thinking about future generations, because some environmental problems have their main negative consequences for for people who aren't here today and now to defend themselves. They can't. They don't have any purchasing power. They don't have any political power. They're not here. They're not going to be here for another 100 or 200 years, sometimes even longer, if you think about long-term pollution like radioactive wastes, for example. And so if we're going to try to bring the well-being of those future generations into the picture, it seems to me that ethics, that an ethic of responsibility towards those who will come after us on this world, just like an ethic of gratitude to those who came before us and made our world and our lives possible, is an important set of values that we ought to inculcate. Now, what do markets do to that? Well, I think markets are, you know, I mean, markets have many wonderful things. I'm not a total anti-market person by any way, shape, or form, but one of the problems with markets is that left to themselves, they don't do a terribly good job of replicating moral capital. And in fact, you can see it in the economics profession, where the idea that people act totally in their own self-interest and that moral values are some, you know, something unconnected with the economy has become the reigning orthodoxy. It almost, the market and market economics tends to glorify amoral behavior, behavior that doesn't take into account consequences on others unless those can somehow get you in trouble. And I think so there tends to be perhaps a corrosive effect. If you think about the moral capital of our society today, how's it sustained? How's it maintained? It's maintained largely outside the market. It's maintained through the family, through what parents and grandparents teach their kids. It's maintained through our religious institutions. It's maintained through community organizations. This is where the kind of bonds of sympathy and trust and solidarity with our fellow human beings are really developed and nurtured. And the market is more like where the law of the jungle, everybody for himself, tends to prevail. So I think, you know, in order to have a successful economy, you need to have both. You need to have markets, but you also need to have something besides markets that helps to govern human behavior and helps to provide the underpinnings for even the markets to work well.
We have just a couple minutes left with James Boyce, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Jim, for those of us who might be cynical or pessimistic about inequality and the extent to which it might grow over the years, given the correlation you've established between inequality of wealth and income and power and environmental damage, what should we remember or what should we know about the long view of human history and whether societies have been moving toward greater inequality or greater equality?
That's a really good question, C.S., and it's an important one to think about and ask ourselves because all too often I think we can really succumb to despair. We look at what's going on out there. We look at the environment being destroyed. We look at the growing inequalities of wealth and power, the activities of the current administration in Washington. There's so much negative stuff out there that people can throw up their hands and just feel like, it's just getting worse and worse all the time. But in fact, if you kind of look back on even not that far back, I think you can see that the trend of history is really towards reduction of inequality. I mean, back in the middle of the 19th century, Karl Marx wrote a book called The Communist Manifesto, which was considered very radical at the time and, you know, helped to set in motion a lot of the state socialist revolutions of the 20th century. One of the demands in there was free public education. That was considered an incredibly radical demand. Well, we have free public education today in the United States. 150 years ago, that wasn't the norm. I mean, it was considered a radical communist demand. If you go back, you know, again, around a similar amount of time, there was still slavery in the United States. 100 years ago, women couldn't vote in the United States. 50 years ago, there was no Environmental Protection Agency in the United States. There was no federal agency in charge of protecting the environment. So over time, I think if you look at progress over the long run, you see that there is a process of what I would describe as spreading democracy, by which I don't just mean, you know, people being able to vote and have the vote count, though that's important, but democracy in the sense of an equalization of the distribution of power, power becoming more widely diffused, rather than concentrated in the hands of a few oligarchs and plutocrats and so on. So, of course, there's a countervailing tendency. Of course, there are tendencies from time to time where the rich are getting richer and their power seems to be on the ascendancy. But I view those as little blips in the curve, and the long-run trend, I think, really is towards greater democracy. Martin Luther King said it really well once in a commencement address he gave in 1965. He said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." And I think Dr. King was right about that.
Well, thank you and Dr. King for those encouraging words. James Boyce teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is with the Political Economy Research Institute. Links to his homepage at UMass Amherst, as well as to his paper, Is Inequality Bad for the Environment, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, C.S. It's been a pleasure.
And the interviewer was C.S. Sung. You can find out more at againstthegrain.org. And as far as the moral arc of the universe is concerned, it only bends towards justice if we bend it. And it always hangs by a thread, given how many of us collaborate with our own oppression. You might remember that much was made of Teamsters and Turtles together at the protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999. The opponents of environmental preservation have always posed the question as one of jobs versus the environment. I first learned this when I was in high school and volunteered to campaign for California's unsuccessful 1972 Clean Environment Initiative, which sought to remove the lead from gasoline and ban the use of the pesticide DDT. Big money was opposing the legislation, led by Standard Oil. No surprise there. But what surprised my young and naive self as I went door to door was the number of people who told me that they had been told by their union to vote against it, as it would threaten jobs. Unions, it seems, learned a thing or two by the battle in Seattle, that the corporations who don't want to clean up their toxic operations also don't want to treat their workers decently, and have since decamped to sweatshops elsewhere. The business media is full of praise for the Chinese economic boom. Accompanying that boom is a giant toxic cloud that chokes the people in China, then crosses 6,000 miles of Pacific Ocean to pollute the air on the west coast of North America. The instigators of the mess are U.S.-based multinationals. The parcel of rogues who began the poisoning of China in the name of free trade are the same U.S. multinationals that got their start poisoning us. They may have decamped, but the poison in our lands and waterways has yet to be cleaned up. And if they think we're desperate enough, they'll be back, ready to do us one more time, demanding that environmental laws be repealed in the name of jobs. That's why a previous speaker on the show, Virginia Rasmussen, was quite clear that sustainable living cannot be achieved without commensurate change in the economic and political systems. This is not merely a hypothetical. A number of independent financial analysts are warning that the U.S. economy is on the verge of a collapse that could bring on a depression like the 1930s or worse. One of the more interesting of these writers is Jim Willey, a PhD statistician and proprietor of a website, goldenjackass.com. He describes the purpose of his site as follows, quote, "The Golden Jackass website is designed to inform and instruct in the complex ways of gold, currencies, bonds, interest rates, stocks, commodities, futures, derivatives, and the world economy, with no respect shown for inept bankers and economists whose policies and practices contribute toward the slow-motion degradation, if not destruction, of the financial world." Close quote. Next, I'm going to read you from an article he wrote on August 30th. It's titled, "Failed System and Failed State." He begins by alluding to the criticism of another financial analyst. Amusement is my response when other writers call me or my work extremist, as Claude Cormier recently has. He's a top-notch analyst out of Quebec whose work is respected and admired. He himself cites extreme events, like comparisons between the United States and Argentina, in the decimation of the middle class amidst prolific inflation and financial sector foul play. Labels are not kind, but my job is to analyze the extreme situation on a host of fronts. To be honest, the label is taken here as an extreme compliment, since it means my perceptions are squarely on target. Additional extreme observations can be detailed, which points to systemic breakdown. The U.S. financial system shows signs of failure, the U.S. economy suffering deeply in association. If one were to list the extreme events and factors in the last few years, reaching a climax nowadays, the recitation would flow over into several dozen pages. As an important U.S. holiday approaches, Labor Day, a reflection is in order of the extremely dangerous footing we find our nation in, and the predicament that a nation of laborers finds itself in. Workers find their situation extremely tenuous, especially in light of the corporate sellout of the American worker in favor of Asians, aided by U.S. government incentives and Wall Street cheers. Our workers became accustomed to the betrayal during the 1980 decade, with the Pacific Rim powered by the Asian tigers. Why cannot economists see that a decade of Vietnam War inflation, a Johnson-Kennedy guns and butter agenda, and U.S. dollar benefit from high Volcker interest rates, leading to the Plaza Accord to bring down the U.S. dollar, resulted in a colossal cost to the U.S. middle class and workers? They took more blows with the 1990 NAFTA betrayal as Mexican assembly plants cropped up across the border. The current Chinese and Indian outsource movement is yet another betrayal to the American worker. Outsource the job, enjoy the lower cost to the corporate profit margin, and send the U.S. employees into the street, especially if they are near retirement with pensions. Let us all celebrate Labor Day, marred by a skein of betrayals. What is needed is a national program to put Americans to work. Instead, we fight an endless, winless war abroad in support of private syndicates who profit heavily. How about a national mandate and high-priority initiative to rebuild the U.S. bridges, access roads to major cities, tunnels, railroads, sewer pipes, water pipes, natural gas pipes, crude oil pipes, airports, and port facilities? And yes, forbid Halliburton and other connected crooks to participate in any and all bidding. F.D. Roosevelt initiated numerous plans. Why not now? High-speed trains are common in France, Germany, Japan, and soon China. The U.S. lags badly. In fact, one can conclude that the U.S. is morphing into a bizarre third-world nation with a powerful military and a banking system well-equipped to abuse the power extended from printing unbacked money marked as the world reserve currency. Reflection at holiday time brings front and center thoughts of how insistence on placing the Iron Triangle, Pentagon, defense firms, and lobby firms in the catbird seat has contributed mightily to the weakening of the U.S. economy, the undermining of the American worker, and the slow bleed of the U.S. middle class. That portion of the federal budget receives almost no debate, no accountability, no prosecution for fraud. In the last 30 years, the inflation-adjusted wages per adult has fallen by 30% to 35%, inflicting great hardship on the family structure. A household needs to enjoin three wage earners, but such is impractical since most offspring are reckless spenders, not effective workers, and since Uncle Charlie, as in the television show My Three Sons, do not fit the mold anymore. It's next to impossible to put one's savings to work without engaging in hijinks gambling. Entire pension funds were killed in the 2000 stock bust. Outside of TIAA CREF, where academic and many institutional pensions are managed, some hefty losses were inflicted. The advent of the 1% official treasury yields enticed many pension managers to take risks which are biting deeply into future retirement income. This all seems wicked and extreme. In fact, the details of the entire national fiscal and economic landscape seem like out of a futuristic science fiction novel with little basis in sanity. The incredible part of the story seems to be that few smart folks cite the extreme nature of it at all. The U.S. financial system, the U.S. economy, the global economy, the U.S. dollar-based banking system, they are all on the brink. Asset-backed bonds have nuked the banking industry. The housing decline puts the U.S. economy at grave risk. The global economy leaves Asians and Persian Gulf nations owning enough U.S. dollar-based debt so as to jeopardize U.S. sovereignty. Call me an extremist. If others do not see the extreme precariousness of the situation, they are compromised, unaware, sleepy, or corrupted. The 2000 tech telecom stock bust provided an earthquake across both the financial sector and the general economy. An official recession was admitted and acknowledged late. That means gross domestic product growth fell below minus 5%. Since the U.S. government gimmicks build in exaggeration by over 4% at least. That fact alone sounds extreme, especially in view of additional distortions, like the consumer price index claimed at 3%, when it runs closer to 11%. Extreme gimmicks remove rising components. Then the unemployment rate is claimed at 4% to 5%, when in reality it is more like 9% when those without jobs are counted, using data released by the same spin doctors at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Productivity would be negative if not for the same gimmicks on hedonic adjustments which assist the GDP. They got caught with bogus statistics last summer on the relationship between productivity and import prices. You cannot import productivity. Distortions in the compass readings are skewed to the extreme, to such a degree that monetary and economic policy cannot remotely be adequate in response to the current conditions. The gulf between official statistics and reality seem extreme. In the wake of the great 2000 stock bust came another even greater extreme. In bizarre yet desperate fashion, hidden, the Greenspan Fed encouraged a housing bubble in order to save its own reputation. The U.S. economy could not afford a recession with all the inherent debt liquidation, so a myth of an asset-driven economy was promoted. That seems extreme for any central bank. Imagine proclaiming as healthy, valid, and with firm foundation an economic dependence on assets, housing, and stocks pushed higher by inflation. A strong economy would rely upon business investment, production, income growth, and sensible spending, not the lunatic retail mania that we find the U.S. economy dependent upon. Almost 30% of all new jobs created since 2002 have been tied to the housing construction bubble. Some call it a boom, but in my view, just another absurd bubble. Imagine instilling a dependence for economic growth on a non-producing asset like a house, instead of a manufacturing plant where value can be added with intellectual capital and jobs created. That is a cockeyed extreme. Imagine the extreme structural imbalance of having 70% of the U.S. economy derived from consumption led by retail. Here, a graph displays the extreme clutter of retail chains within the U.S. landscape. this sevenfold greater retail footprint of the U.S. consumption over European footprints is absurd. This is a ridiculous extreme. Willie then shows a chart, which is the retail sales footprint expressed in square foot per capita. That means the number of square feet of retail space for each person in the United States, which happens to be 20.2 square feet, as opposed to Sweden with 3.3 square feet, or the UK with 2.5 square feet, France with 2.3, Italy with 1.1. And Willie continues. Then we saw a stock market reach new nominal highs, set records, as an economic boom is heralded. All pure extreme nonsense. Since the U.S. dollar fell by roughly the same 15% to 20% as the stock market indexes rose. Hence, the purchasing power of one Dow share or one of the S&P 500 share has been preserved. This is a wash, not a boom. One might even ask why the S&P stock index is part of the U.S.-based leading economic indicators, when over 30% of profit from such firms is derived from outside the U.S. economy. The recent Cisco Systems quarterly report highlighted this effect. Strong business abroad, weak at home. The U.S. Federal Reserve, in the meantime, has made official statements incessantly referring to their fears of price inflation, when what they really mean is the U.S. dollar might fall to such low levels that imported price inflation would threaten the entire U.S. economy. They fear a backlash from exported inflation, soon importing it. So the U.S. Fed cannot talk about the U.S. dollar currency exchange rate directly. Yet its policy can easily cause a rout on the U.S. dollar with all its price inflation consequences. That puts the U.S. Fed in an extreme box. The aftermaths of extremely incompetent economic guidance and planning, combined with irresponsible, heretical banking policy, have led to an utterly unfixable housing crisis and mortgage finance debacle. This mess has years for dust to clear. The entire non-government bond market has fallen into a situation difficult to adequately describe. How about comparisons to a human body suffering from seizures from bubbles in its arteries from inflation of assets, then deflation, but also beset by constipation from fraudulent asset-backed bonds like mortgages and associated leveraged CDO bond derivatives. Sounds about right, but again, quite an extreme situation. With the threat to money market funds, whether insured or not, the entire banking system seems to be at risk of proper function. Musical chairs come to mind, which demand players find a seat when the music credit flow stops. Hot potato comes to mind, much like the Drexel-Burnham plight, which demands players to not hold the acidic worthless bonds. My claim is that all subprime mortgage bonds are worth under 25 cents of par value, and all collateralized debt obligations with dominant subprime mortgage bonds are totally worthless, as in 100% loss. Actually, the CDO bond losses are much greater than 100%. Sure to bite deeply into the value of other assets of good value, like gold and crude oil contracts. To me, the banking situation is on the ropes, an extremely dire picture. With most Wall Street firms facing junk bond status downgrades according to credit default swaps on their corporate debt, yet enjoying wonderful investment-grade ratings, we have more extreme corruption in the banker brokerage system.